Project doing another Monster in a Glass episode, looking at another cocktail, a cocktail that you would think was just like a slam dunk because the name, the Ford cocktail, it makes you think, oh, it's going to be about cars. It goes much deeper and stranger, and there's a seedy underside. There's drama and horror. And there's also Jason Cruz. He's sitting here. Which is also horror. He is our historian and researcher. He's done some research on the Ford cocktail, and he's going to tell you about it.
So the Ford cocktail, and I'll just go into a little bit about what Hanks gives as an explanation. So he does say the Ford cocktail definitely predated Henry Ford's rise and that of the horseless carriage that bore his name. Now, where he got the recipe is from George, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this, but I'm going to say George Kappeler's Modern American Drinks, which I've used for a number of the drinks we've done.
Really?
Yes.
I have not heard his name before.
It's an early one. It's 1895, so it's not one of the earliest, but it's kind of on the cusp. But a lot of people... It's no Harry Johnson. No, well, what is? If you look around online, people point to this book as really being a great book. And so he did a lot of cocktails as well. So this is where the Ford cocktail came from. And as far as I could tell, it's the truth. I didn't find it anywhere else listed. One thing that Haig mentions too, and we'll come back to this in a little bit, it was possibly named for Malcolm Webster Ford, a famed champion athlete, journalist, and great-grandson of Noah Webster. He says fully five other drinks contain almost the same components. And I tend to believe in Mir because as I could not find any other recipe for a Ford cocktail, I did find another recipe in Straub's Manual of Mixed Drinks from 1913 called the Poet's Dream Cocktail, which was the exact same ingredients. Aside from the levels, I think it was 2 dashes of Benedictine versus 3 in the Kappeler, but it was dry gin and vermouth. It was exactly the same recipe. So I would believe that this drink truly is not something that is totally original. The ingredients are not that uncommon in cocktails. The combination, I think Benedictine is really the kind of the outlier there. It shows up in a lot of recipes, but you know, I found other recipes too, like the Klondike cocktail, which calls for eau de vie instead of vermouth. But it was pretty much the same recipe. So I would say that this is another instance of the recipe was out there. People were making it, calling it whatever.
Do you think that they were taking the recipe and applying a different name? Or do you think that this combination was just so obvious that everybody hit on it independently?
Well, the Kappeler drink came out in 1895 under this name. I didn't find anything earlier than that used that exact same combination, but it's hard to search by ingredients because, you know, when you're searching at gin drinks, you could sit all day and look through gin drinks. And, you know, even with Benedictine, which, you know, you're not going to get too many irrelevant results searching for Benedictine. I didn't quite find anything other than this Poet's Dream cocktail in 1913. So I just think it became, and it's like, well, this, you know, hey, look, we found this recipe and we'll call it the Poet's Dream instead of the Ford cocktail. Let's just say going into this, it's impossible to tell why the drink is called the Ford's cocktail. There's theories. We'll talk about some of the theories. But yeah, I think that these ingredients tend to be used a lot. But the name, as I said, we'll never know. We'll never know for sure.
Okay, so Henry Ford, the automobile manufacturer.
I would say not, although Haig says, well, this is well before the horseless carriage, and it's not entirely true. In one way, depending on how you read what he's saying, is it was slightly before Ford became really popular with his horseless carriage and his cars, but he built his first automobile, the first prototype, in 1896, so it was right around the same time that this drink came out. You got to figure he was messing around with this technology beforehand. And actually, the first gasoline-powered automobile in America was built by James and Charles Duryea in 1893. And cars had been around before that as well. Carl Benz and Gottlieb Daimler. Benz and Daimler, those are pretty famous names, built a self-propelling model in 1886 in Europe. So the car had kind of been around before that in incarnations. I don't know that Ford was a household name at that time. I also don't know what George Kapler's relationship to Henry Ford was. Maybe there was none at all. Maybe they were good buds. I don't know. But
do we know where Henry Ford lived?
Detroit. So, and George Kapler, I think, was in Manhattan.
So was it Harrison Ford?
Yeah, let's go with that. I like that one.
Harrison Ford?
It was Harrison Ford.
How about Ford Prefect from A Hitchhiker's Guide?
Yeah, it was Ford Prefect. He clearly was a fan.
of Douglas Adams.
This is one of those things when a term is or a name is so generic like this, it makes it really hard to search. It makes it really hard to figure out. It could have been somebody named Ford walked in and said, "I want this drink with these ingredients. Make it for me. My name's Ford." And George Kapler said, "Sounds great. I'll throw that in my recipe book that I'm coming out with." You know, it could be Ford's Theater. This is not too long after Lincoln was assassinated, although the ingredients don't really...
Not too long. It seems like ages.
Well, 1895 was when he has the book listed, so... Well, 30 years, so...
Well, like, the difference in culture is vastly different from the time. I mean...
Right. No, and I'm just throwing that out
there. No, I know.
Yeah, clearly. It could be Harrison Ford, for all we know.
No, it can't be Harrison Ford.
Hey, he could have traveled back in time, met George Kapler.
In the Millennium Falcon, yeah.
Right.
So, have you explored the Malcolm Webster Ford angle?
I did, and, you know,
again... Who is Malcolm Webster Ford?
Malcolm Webster Ford was a famous athlete during the 1880s, not the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So, it fits within the time frame that Kapler wrote down his drink. He was a triathlete. Or something to that effect. But during the time... You know, here's what's weird. Is that during the time that Kapler created the drink, he had not been an athlete at the time. He was an athlete in the 1880s. The drink was created in the 1890s. And
can I shed some light?
Go for it.
Okay. Whenever we go into people, I go nuts. Because the way people's lives turn out in any era is fascinating. Because we can all relate... Usually on some level, even if they have vastly different lives and mm-hmm. ways of looking at the world, but there's always something we can grasp onto. And when you mentioned this connection, I wanted to see if I could find it. Okay, so the thing is that the Ford family, whose great-grandfather was Daniel Webster, by the way, famous author, famous American.
Noah Webster.
What?
Noah Webster.
No, the great-grandfather was Daniel Webster.
I thought it was Noah Webster.
The great-grandfather.
Oh, the great-grandfather, yeah.
And then the grandfather.
Daniel was, yeah.
It was Noah Webster. So, like, this family has a lot of literary chutzpah. They're aristocrats of letters, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, so Malcolm Webster Ford, in the 1880s, decided to become an athlete. He was 5'10". Like, I think 160 pounds, something like that. And he was very well built. He was a strong individual. And next to his father and his brother, they were both very literary, very scholarly individuals. But he decided to separate himself and become an athlete. And he did very well. He wanted to become the best athlete. In fact, his father opposed him in his athletic endeavors. And so he said, well... If you're going to oppose me, then not only will I be just an athlete, I will become the best one. And he promptly started doing that. Exactly, pretty much. In the 1880s, he became 3-time American national champion, all-around athlete, which was like a decathlon, 10 events. By age 21, he was winning awards. Mm. So he was, in the prime of his life, he was kicking ass, basically. In 1885 and 1886... He was the winner of long jump, 100-yard dash, and 200-yard dash. And he held that triple record until 1983 when Carl Lewis.
Yeah, I know. I was reading that. I was like, holy shit.
This guy was no joke.
Yeah.
He was a serious athlete.
Yeah.
And he did that by age 24. Okay, so you just look at this and you can see if it was during our day and age, people would be just like going crazy. And mm-hmm. back then, I don't know what it was like. But
yeah.
The issue that I had, the challenge that happens in the story is that even when he was winning awards, his father opposed it. As an athlete, he kept along that track. He was playing in the amateurs. Amateurs were more for the wealthy. It was more of a club type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you stayed as an amateur, then you could be in there. And he stayed as an amateur, you know, basically was kicking butt at that level. But then there was a scandal where he apparently competed professionally under an assumed name.
Oh, no.
Well, it was claimed that he did, but he denied it. But just having that come out became kind of a problem. And not only that, as a member of these clubs, he was kind of a diva. He would get snotty and whiny and complain about the way he was being treated, like he was some kind of special individual and that he should get some kind of better treatment.
Well, he's a Webster, damn it.
But he was also the best athlete in the country, you know? It's like, that's not anything to sneeze at, but at the same time, you have to be a decent person, so...
Yeah.
There was that. So he wasn't very popular, and he had a kind of repellent personality, ultimately.
An athlete with a repellent personality?
No that, way.
What? This is unheard of.
Back to his father. Regardless of all of his winning at the sports, his father still said, you're a loser.
This because, is setting up a perfectly stable human being.
I know. It's like, holy
You're the best in the world? I don't believe it.
Okay. So he was an athlete, and his father still thought that was a worthless endeavor because these people, the whole family was born and raised in literary endeavors. His brother, Paul, was a biographer for George Washington, Ben Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. Yeah. So he's like talking about the big guys.
Do you know what's interesting, too, is that Paul Lester Ford, the Thomas Jefferson autobiography, he wrote the autobiography of Thomas Jefferson. The biography he wrote about Thomas Jefferson, I was reading that up until like the the 20th century, it was known as like the most authoritative source.
You've got to be kidding.
That it was the source that people turned to.
That was 100 years ago.
That's what they meant. Oh my God. Yeah, okay. It was so thorough. But you got to figure 1880s is a little closer to Thomas Jefferson than the 1950s.
I feel like back then people weren't as aware of the kinds of issues that postmodernism brought out.
True, but if you're looking at a biography, he just seemed to have a knack for it. I mean, he wrote novels too, but it seemed like he was known more for his biographies than he was known for his novels.
Okay. Well, so his brother Paul is a contrast to Malcolm.
Mm-hmm. The good son.
The good son versus the bad son. In addition, though, and this is kind of where it rolls back into where it might be related to the drink, is that he was known for spending a lot of money and being very flamboyant and partying a lot. Huh. Malcolm Ford became famous, and he loved it, and he partied like an NFL player.
As he should.
And his father, of course, rejected that as well. And, you know, the thing is that maybe the partying happened because of that rejection, because, you know, he wasn't in. He was the black sheep of the family anyway. So he might as well go out and drink all the time. So after his athletic career, he got married in 1893, became a business executive, and I don't think that really worked out.
Wasn't he also a journalist?
Yes, he was a journalist.
And I think he wrote about track and field.
He was a sports writer. Before that, though, in 1892, his father took care of him when he was suffering from typhoid. Hmm. And in the process of taking care of him, Malcolm's father, Gordon, contracted typhoid as well.
Interesting.
So Malcolm survived and Gordon died. Hey. So his father passed away in taking care of him. Before that, because Malcolm had already been shunned by his father, he'd kind of been separated from the family, and then when his father passed away, there was a question as to the inheritance. And there was a lot of claim that Malcolm didn't get anything. And that's the way it ended up.
Well, he was the second son. Wasn't Paul the older of the...
That wasn't part of the thing back then. It was more about...
Are you sure?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Malcolm was cut out of the inheritance entirely.
So it was more of just a dick move on his father for not
approving. In fact, Paul said about the whole instance of his father, he said he gave a worthy life to save an unworthy life. This is what he told to the judge when they were, hashing out the inheritance, the legalities of the inheritance. So basically, Malcolm was cut out of the inheritance, and that was a crushing blow. You mentioned the journalism thing. He became an editor of a magazine. He started his own magazine, his own publication.
It was called, like, what was it called? Like, Outing or something like...
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. Something like that.
Maybe that has something to do with why his wife left him. Because he was divorced at some point. No, I doubt it. Because actually, it sounds like Malcolm kind of lost his shit. There was a divorce, and get this, Malcolm got custody of their 2-year-old son. Now, would that have been common back then, or would that have been strange?
My gut feeling is to say actually it was probably more common, because if you think about time period... In the ideas floating around about women is that they are emotional,
but they always would have been the caretakers for children.
It's a fuzzy area, because my first instinct is to say if the father wanted the child, it would be more likely that the father would get the child. That being said, how often did the father want the custody of the children?
Yeah.
So, and divorce wasn't that common.
No. So. No. And seeing that shocked me. I looked everywhere to find out the reason. Mm. Nothing.
He was famous, too, so that's...
I know. There is that. But the mother was an heiress. Graves Ford was an heiress. She was very wealthy in her own right. She got married later after. But in the interim, in 1902, Malcolm walks into his brother's office, and there's a heated discussion, and then he pulls out a gun and shoots him, and then shoots himself.
Wasn't the rumor I saw was that it was about money, that yes. He was going to his brother for money.
Well, apparently, according to his wife, she made a statement after the incident saying that basically he had lost his mind since he was cut out of the inheritance, and all of his business endeavors had failed over and over and over. The magazine failed, his business endeavors failed, nothing was working out for him, and he was just kind of crazy. And regarding the divorce and his separation from his wife, I kind of wonder if he was crazy and then crazier. And then she left him, or if she left him and then he got even crazier. It sounds like he was obsessing about the inheritance thing. There's also, you know, I think also to the story called Babylon Revisited by F. Scott Fitzgerald, where you watch a man descend into alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wonder if there's a little bit of that going on. Especially if this guy has a cocktail named after him, which we haven't verified, but, you know, it's a possibility. They're in the same town.
Yeah.
It's known that he's a partier. If that had something to do with it, if he was descending into alcoholism, and not only was that making him depressed or crazy or whatever, then you have the incidents in his life, and then it all kind of culminates, and then eventually
it's a murder suicide. I mean, it's almost like a stereotype. When you look at it, like his character, and it's like, well, he had daddy issues, and then his dad died taking care of him, and then he got cut out of the will because he was the shitty son. And then he was a victim, and then, you know, his brother probably wasn't very nice to him and had all the money from the inheritance and was successful, and if he did even have a minor alcohol problem. You know, it's just like, well, yeah, like, this is how characters are written. Yeah, it almost sounds like a book. Like, well, there's this story about an athlete who eventually killed his brother. It sounds weird that you would go, like, when it's like, well, I saw the initial things I was seeing was like, was a murder-suicide, and I was like, oh, did he kill his wife? Like, that was my first thought. Mm-hmm. And then it's like his brother, and you're like, his brother, why? Like, what did he kill his brother for? Like, that's strange.
Yeah.
But not so strange when you start looking at what was going on.
But you look at the news now and you see incidents. We only see... These people were the aristocrats of New York, Manhattan, you know, of the time. And so they made the headlines. They were in the newspapers. And so that's why we have this.
You know, if he was a partier and he was around the time period and he was...
And frankly, if you look at Fitzgerald... And the things that he wrote, like The Lost Decade, it's about that kind of thing. The partying was just nonstop in this period, and especially, you know, for the aristocrats, for the money classes. And
what else do you do? I mean, like, you don't need to work. you just live off of money. And especially when you're the second son, you're probably not... that's just typical throughout history. The second, the third sons, you didn't do shit. You weren't going to get the inheritance. That was for damn sure. The first son got everything. The second son, do what you want. I mean, there was a story somebody was just telling me recently. Jamestown, somebody was talking about. They walked in, and the reports were, there were all these young men bowling. And they were like, you guys are starving to death. You don't have any food. What's going on here? Why are you guys bowling? Well, they were the second sons. They weren't expected to work. They weren't going to get any inheritance. They didn't know any trade. They were just like, well, we were always told to just go, fucking sit over there and, dick around. Stay out of the way. So it was like when they came, and it's like, well, the first sons died off. So they have all the second sons. So this theme, this idea of the non-first sons, they didn't stand really to inherit anything. So what do you do? It's not that far off from now. I mean, you have all these spoiled
do nothing. By the fact that there was even an argument. In fact, it went to the courts.
Yeah.
The inheritance.
Well, I mean, this was a little later. I mean, this was 19th century. But it's that same idea that it probably had more to do with you follow in the family name. We're Webster's, and you do what we do.
And then, he attempted journalism. He attempted to become the editor of his own magazine. And it failed. It's like, oh, shit. Well, you're not really a member of the family. You suck at what the family does.
I wonder if the father even looked down upon that. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, that's not real writing. You're writing about athletics in a magazine.
Yeah.
You're not writing really.
Yeah. Well, I don't think the father was even alive by that time.
Mm. No, that's true, yeah.
He passed away in 1892.
His father was still there.
You know it.
Yeah.
He's totally there. So
the demons.
If that is the origin of the Ford cocktail, actually, let's just make it the origin of the Ford.
I'm going to say it is.
It's more fun. It's awesome.
Let's say this. It probably wasn't named after Henry Ford.
No. Or Harrison Ford, or Ford Prefect.
Right, exactly. I'm not convinced yet that it's not named after Harrison Ford, but unlikely. Yes, I would say this is the most likely. It was the time period fits. Henry Ford was around, but in a way, he probably wasn't as famous as he became.
And he was in Detroit.
And he
probably didn't party as much as Malcolm Webster Ford.
Maybe it was named after Gerald Ford or Betty Ford. That even makes more sense.
Oh, God.
100 years to her.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Is that all of it?
That's all I got.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, then, I guess we will bring this to the tasting team and hope there's no murder suicides.
The Ford Cocktail. 1 ounce Heyman's Old Tom Gin. 1 ounce Noily Pratt Dry Vermouth. 3 dashes Benedictine. 3 dashes Fee Brothers Orange Bitters.
Okay, everyone, so we are now at the Brixton going to do the tastings. We've just heard the crazy story of the Ford's cocktail. Oh, it's not really the crazy story of the cocktail. It's the background. It's the days of our lives from 1900s. The Ford cocktail is Old Tom Gin, Dry Vermouth, Benedictine, and Michael has already brought us some samples of two of those ingredients because we're not as familiar with them. The Old Tom Gin and the Benedictine. So let's see. I'm trying to figure out which is which. Okay, so that's the Old Tom Gin.
Yeah. You can definitely tell which is which when you smell them.
Okay, so I am joined here today by Kevin Rutajczyk.
Hello.
Kevin, have you ever wanted to shoot your brother or sister?
I have only a younger sister.
And has she survived?
She did survive.
That's excellent. Here, try some Old Tom Gin.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Delicious.
Yeah. It's good stuff. And I'm also joined by Rachel Rubin. Good evening.
Good evening.
Have you ever wanted to shoot your brother or sister?
No, I don't have any brothers or sisters.
You're so lucky. Try some Old Tom gin.
Ooh.
Now, you know gin, right? You're familiar with gin, regular gin.
Yes.
What do you think of that in comparison?
I think it fits Michael's earlier description of oily. I think it is kind of oily. I hope this isn't the dry one, because this doesn't seem very dry.
No, I think it's a sweeter kind. I saw that the description is kind of between Jennifer, which is like baby gin, and what we drink now. Remember the Swedish punch was kind of like baby rum?
Yeah.
Jennifer is like baby gin. And this is like the missing link.
Yeah, that description really makes a lot of sense. There's a little teeny bit of sweetness, in that I think it just kind of takes away some of the burn of the alcohol. Like if this was a drier gin, I think it would burn more. But it doesn't necessarily taste very sweet, but there's more flavors to it. It's good.
It just is not very floral.
Now, we're also joined by Nicole Pizzini, and she's got her nose in the gin. So have you ever wanted to shoot your brother or sister?
No, we have a pretty good relationship. We know when to stay apart.
No, like, extreme situations where you wanted to do a murder-suicide or anything like that?
I was the oldest, so I had to be responsible and not pick on them too much.
Oh, so it's their responsibility to commit the murder-suicide.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah.
So what do you think? So drink the Old Tom gin.
Yeah, that's all juniper. It's not so much anything else. And yeah, I get the hint of sweet, too. I drink more of that.
Now, I've heard that that Old Tom gin comes from... There used to be wooden plaques on the wall with a black cat, a black tomcat. And there was a period of time when everybody in England thought that gin was destroying the world. Because, like, everybody was drinking gin. And they were saying it was a problem. And so, on the plaque, they would have a slot underneath the paw of the cat. And you would walk up to the plaque and slide a coin into the slot. And then there would be a lead pipe that ran out through the wall, and the bartender would pour a shot of gin into that pipe, and then you could drink. In secret, on the street.
Oh. But through a lead pipe.
That was, that's kind
of... I'm not digging.
Yeah, that's kind of... Maybe the problem wasn't the gin so much as drinking from lead.
Maybe that's why it had some added sweetness.
I was actually thinking that too.
You know what? I think it does. I don't know what lead tastes like, but I think the ancient Romans did add it as an additive to food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it has a sweet taste. Why are paint chips something that you have to keep kids away from?
Because they taste good.
Because they're delicious.
Yummy lead.
That's always something that I wondered. It's like, why are kids eating paint chips? They're delicious.
Kids put lots of things in their mouths, though.
Yeah, but when they seek them out to consume them in large quantities so that you have to, say, keep the lead paint away because they will eat it. Okay, I'm going to try the Old Tom gin. I've had it before, and I dig it. It's a toss-up for me between barrel-aged gin and Old Tom.
Yeah, I think it's barrel. I noticed kind of like a barrel-aged flavor, aged flavor to it.
Yeah. This wouldn't be barrel aged though. There's no color.
No. Unlike the Benedictine, which has definitely got a lot of color to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I like this. I like this a lot. Okay, now the other taste that we have in front of us is Benedictine. It's a fancy liqueur from a part of France, and I believe it's got an association with a town. And it's all part of the, marketing thing that they arranged.
Do monks make it or something like that?
I think originally, but basically there's only three people who know the recipe at any given time.
Oh, wow.
So a well-placed cadre of assassins could wipe out the entire... Gotcha. And they have a hall of counterfeits at their distillery because people have been trying to make this for years and years and years and bottling it as Benedictine, but then they sue their asses and it's the end of that. And then they end up on the wall of shame. What is the smell like? It smells like something, and I'm not sure. Rachel has to...
It's a little bourbony.
It's not quite that. That's not what I'm... Rachel has to smell it because she always comes up with the best associations.
Yeah, now the pressure's on.
It smells like grandma and some sort of, like, cinnamony baked good.
Really? You think so?
Yeah.
We gotta get Nikki's opinion, too.
Yeah, yeah. Tastes like that, too.
It tastes like grandma, cinnamon grandma?
Mm-hmm.
Cinnamon grandma's.
You know, I think it smells like bourbon.
I think it smells like cherry flavoring.
Cherry flavor?
Your olfactories have been destroyed by all the previous drinks we've done.
Yeah, maybe.
It's all like the cherry fire.
I get some cherry in there too. It's like floral, fruity, with a little bit of... Yeah, with a little bit of...
I didn't taste it yet.
Like peach pit or something. That sort of almondy... Maybe it's not cinnamon, maybe it's almond. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Because they smell
so
exactly
the same. So it's grandma and almond cookies, that's what I get. Yeah, almond cookie.
Maybe that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and because there's a little...
Because it needed the cookie. It wasn't just almond.
Like the windmill there's a little almond bit of, cookies.
There's a little bit of like fruitiness and a little bit of floral, which I think of, which I kind of associate with like grandma perfume.
Jeez, Nicole looks in pain.
It's tricky. It seems so syrupy and sweet, and then it just sort of like stabs you with that alcohol.
It burns?
More than I expected.
The Benedictine, it burns!
It's extremely sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, to me it smells a little bit like a sweet bourbon, but it's much syrupier.
It's weird because usually when you get something a little sweeter, it doesn't burn as much, but this still burns.
Yeah, but it's, you know what? It goes away right away like
so it's like sweet and yet kind of sticky and oily. It's napalm.
Yeah, but no, but it doesn't linger.
Like, it's got the burn and then it sticks.
It's grandma's almond cookie napalm. Yeah, it's like grandma gives you like a big hug and then smacks you in the face with a cookie.
No. No, but Cam, the fire doesn't linger. The sweetness lingers.
Okay.
There's no, like, you get a little shot of it and then it's just sweet again like syrup.
Oh, quit bogarting the Benedictine. it's just, it's strange.
Candy.
It tastes kind of like, it's very sweet.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that, like the Arak, like the Swedish punch, a little bit. Except it's got more herbal stuff to it.
Yeah.
And like the initial taste is a little bit like canned air.
Nitrous?
Yeah, maybe it's like being at the dentist.
Or a dead show.
Like when they put the mask over, it's like the rubber thing.
Yeah.
Doing whippets in the Dairy Queen parking lot. That's always been my youth.
We do not condone.
No,
we do not condone these. Hey, wait, no, we don't condone these things.
That's great.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wouldn't say it's bad.
No.
I could sit and enjoy that. I could like sip a small egg cup of it. Yeah. Yeah.
I want it mixed with something.
Yeah, me too.
It's really, really, really sweet.
With Coke?
No, something.
What would you mix it with?
Hopefully this drink we're getting.
Okay.
Gin would be good. Do you want something bitter with it?
Soda water?
Something bright.
Turn it into a cola, into a soda beverage?
Yeah.
Benedictine soda.
Could be interesting.
Yeah.
You could sell that at Whole Foods, I'm sure.
Bethany would buy it. It's true. Bethany would love this liqueur. And she loves weird sodas from Whole Foods.
So what did you think of the Malcolm Ford story?
That was an entertaining story. It was kind of crazy. It sounded like an amazing soap opera.
Do you feel like you could identify with any of that? Like, it's from more than 100 years ago.
No, yet... It sounds like it could happen today.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I remember Jay was mentioning, too, like, you know, sometimes, like, athletes and stuff, when they rise to the top, kind of get larger than life and just get kind of crazy. And, yeah, it does. It sounds totally like it could happen today. And also, too, this guy was not only was he the best, he also was probably really, you know, super privileged and stuff. And so, like, he really had no recourse. He was at the end of his rope. Like, he, you know, he's not the type to, like...
But do you think he really was? I mean, you think about it. He had to have been way better off than, like, 90% of the people back then.
Yeah, but he probably blew all of it. You know, like, if he had just shown some restraint, he probably would have had some bucks. Because, like, you know, he had, like, he just lived off the interest of his little, you know, allowance that he had before his dad completely lost all faith in him. He'd be okay.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's a case of not being able to live a certain way as well. I mean, like, I heard that the other day Bill Gates found out he had as much money as Oprah Winfrey had, and he threw himself out a window.
Well, it took me a minute.
He was a playboy, and then, like, things get hard. I just feel like it's more than money. I'm a loser. Nothing will work for me. I can't make anything happen.
And if he did come from such a wealthy family, there would have been certain expectations of what was and was not acceptable for him to do to make money. You know, if he was, like, making shoes, that would have also been scorned, you know? Something like a magazine was probably the best he could do.
And the cocktails have arrived. The Ford cocktail. It looks like...
Pretty color. Oh, and I smell the orange peel.
Nice. Getting three of them.
All right. You know, a classic drink, no doubt about it. Like I said, there's this drink comes in a variety of forms. People do this with sweet vermouth. People do this with, like, more Benedictine, less vermouth. And they're all called different drinks. But the gin, Benedictine, and vermouth with bitters has been a popular drink in a variety of forms for years. This one, I believe, according to your literature, is, you know, roughly a little over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And I agree, with your literature, that it's a perfect mix. I think, you know, so many people, I think, are used to just drinking a gin martini. Gin with just a dash of vermouth. And this is a whole ounce of vermouth.
Yeah, okay.
And it's like, it's not the strongest drink in the world. A very little bit of Benedictine just to add a little sweetness to it. And then the orange bitters, which obviously works well with gin and adds a, you know, a kind of a floral nose to it, a citrus nose to it. So it's an ounce of the Old Tom Gin. Old Tom is a style. We use the Heyman's Old Tom Gin.
Heyman's
Old Tom Gin. But normally, where there are a lot of old Toms on the market, per se, Heyman's is certainly a popular one in the Chicago area.
Okay, awesome.
And a good one, and a classic one. So we also use the Nolly Pratt dry vermouth.
Okay.
And then finally...
Benedictine comes from one place, right?
One place. So there's only one Benedictine.
Yeah.
And then the Fee Brothers orange bitters, which I think the Fee Brothers make an excellent bitters.
Fantastic.
I'll say enjoy. I'll be back to check in. Okay. And a little orange twist on top, too, just again to accent the citrus.
Thank you very much, Mike. Mm-hmm.
You know me, this drink is a wonderful drink. It's just not strong enough for me. You know? I don't know what that says about me, other than what it says exactly about me.
It smells like orange hard candy.
Yeah, it is.
That gin keeps it from being too sweet, though. It's much more botanical than I expected when I smelled it.
Even though I'm not, like, head over heels about citrus, I kind of just want to sit here and smell this.
I could smell him when he brought him over to the table. This is really good.
Yeah, you're totally right. Orange hard candy.
That vermouth makes it more salty, too, so it doesn't get totally taken over by that candy-like Benedictine.
Yeah. I have to admit, I'm kind of gobsmacked on this. It does not taste at all like it smells.
I would imagine you're getting a lot of the gin and vermouth. I'd imagine you get a lot of vermouth.
Yeah, definitely.
But it smells just like an orange candy.
Yeah.
It's good. I like it.
On the palate, is there any citrus?
A little bit.
A little, but it's pretty salty.
Very little bit.
Yeah.
Very little bit. That's why I was surprised. You smell it, and it smells like, you know, something just very orangey. You drink it, and it's like there is a tiny bit of citrus.
Sure. It's interesting. Interesting.
I like that it doesn't taste like orange candy.
Yeah.
Like, I can go buy an orange soda.
I find it disconcerting a little bit.
It is kind of
like
weird.
Citrus.
It's kind of weird, like, drinking it, too, because, you know, like, smell does play into when you eat.
Yeah.
And it's, like, conflicting.
Normally, I would make this drink with probably as much as a half ounce of Benedictine, and I wouldn't use as much dry vermouth.
Okay.
I try and stay away from more than a half ounce of vermouths. I know that Manhattans call for a lot of vermouth. I prefer mine without as much. I'm not a big vermouth guy. High-end red vermouths I like on the rocks, but just your mixing vermouths, I think, just tend to be a little much. In this drink, the Benedictine is going to add your sweetener, and they're using three dashes. I used about maybe a quarter ounce to an eighth of an ounce. I would prefer to use as much as a half ounce.
Wow. Yeah, you could use it. Like, when I tried the Benedictine straight, it was very sweet. It was nice, but it was
nice.
Like, potent, though.
No
really
doubt about
sweet.
It. Yeah.
I wouldn't mind even having a little more of that.
You could see, you know, it's just like, the drink is, it's a light-looking drink, and I would think that drink would be a little darker. But, you know, three dashes of, you know, the recipe calls for three dashes of, you know, and again, you're putting three dashes of bitters, so it's calling for a couple of dashes. You can't put too much in, or you're kind of, you know, bastardizing them a little bit. So, but that would be my suggestion for that drink.
I mean, you look at it, it is essentially a martini.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A wet martini.
Absolutely.
And that's the old way they used to do it. Now, if you ask for a martini, it's they just wave the bottle at it. That's
yeah, they salute the bottle on the way by.
It's good. I do get the impression that it's a very strong drink.
If it didn't have the bitter end, because you get kind of a little bit of bitter at the end, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If it didn't have that, I would like want to sip this on the veranda.
Yeah, I think it still lends itself to sipping it on the veranda. Sure.
I think it could use some more of the sweetness in it.
I'm glad it has Old Tom gin.
Yeah.
Because if it was regular gin, I don't think I would like it as much.
No.
Agreed.
Yeah, I agree. It tastes really good if you're already eating something salty. Because then it tastes less salty in comparison. I think if I ordered this out, I wouldn't be disappointed when I received it, but I probably wouldn't order another one. But if I was like at a party and these are being served, I would have several. How's that for a?
That's
for
a good assessment.
I mean,
I'm trying to assess that in relation to. See, I don't care for martinis that much.
Yeah.
So that's what this is, but the I feel like the addition of the Benedictine and the Old Tom Gin puts it on the side of good.
You're torn. You don't feel like you should like it.
I don't think. Yeah, I don't think that I don't think that I would order this necessarily, but I have no problem drinking. I would have no problem drinking several of them if that's what the offering was.
Yeah, it's a little more complex than a martini. Well, of course, depending on what you make the martini with, but there's just a lot going on. You know, you've got the sweet, the salty, the bitter. There's lots of different flavors that hit you at different times. This particular drink.
Yeah.
I would say the aroma is awesome, and when it first hits your tongue, it's really tasty too. The finish, though, is not my favorite. That's my least favorite part, I think, about this.
So the bitterness?
It's just a little too much.
Lingers on the back of your tongue.
I mean, when you revisit it, the smell and the when it first hits your tongue, you're like, oh, wow, that is really good. And it's like, oh, yeah, maybe I should hang out for a second.
Well, then you just have to keep drinking it.
Well, that's true.
I think that's the solution.
I think it's interesting that we can all identify the same experience in a way. Because, mm-hmm. Like, I get that bitterness and then the sweetness and the saltiness up front and everything.
I'd probably still order a martini. With really nice gin. I like this gin. I like all the flavors. It's not, like, knock you down spectacular. It's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and honestly, for me, if this just stayed sweet instead of turning a little bit salty bitter, I wouldn't like it.
It'd be kind of boring.
It'd be really boring. It would just be like a orange soda. I like that it shifts, has more happening.
It's a dynamic drink. Mm-hmm. It shifts. It moves. It's amorphous.
So what's the consensus on the Ford cocktail?
Yeah, what do you think about the Ford cocktail, Kevin?
I like it. I think it's fine. It's just a little too bitter. I think if it had a little more of the Benedictine in it, I would prefer it. But, yeah, it's fine. I'd drink it again. Don't know if I'd order it, but pleased to have one.
The interesting thing is you could, I mean, Benedictine, it's just, they're just using a little teeny bit, and it's just some strange liqueur. And there's about a half a gazillion strange liqueurs. So you could make a martini with a few dashes of each one of those and have a different cocktail.
That's true. It, like a very, you know, wet martini.
You said that you would drink them if they were provided for you.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
What else fits in that category?
Many things.
Yes. Basically, if it doesn't make you gag.
Yeah, I mean,
bad beer is in that category, right?
Sure.
This is like a bad beer.
No. I would gladly accept it if it was given to me. I would be pleased. I would be pleasantly.
You would not be pleased if someone gave you an Old Style.
Well, I don't mind Old Style.
Okay, so there's my point. This is like a bad beer.
I'm trying to think of something that I would drink, but I don't necessarily like.
Zima.
Yeah, malt. No, I wouldn't. I won't even drink like malt beverages. Ugh, gross.
The sugary malty.
Ugh, it'll just give me a stomach ache. I would not drink that. I would rather not drink it all.
Mike's
than drink
Hard
that.
Lemonade.
Oh God, no.
King Cobra.
Oh, now you're talking about fine malt liquor.
You know. Steel Reserve, Old English.
So if someone give you a 40, a Ford cocktail, a Ford E.
Colt 45.
Oh, shit. I mean, Lincoln's. I would accept that as a challenge, and I would do my darndest. If someone was having a, like, this would be, I would think, a pretty fancy party if you were going to have, like, a signature cocktail that you're going to be serving all night.
Signature cocktail. Crazy horse.
But
comes
like,
in a big-ass bottle.
But if somebody, like, had, or you know, was, like, had, was serving these all night long, I'd be like, oh, wow, this is really, you put forth some effort into individually creating these drinks, and that's pretty cool. I will have many. Whereas, like, if, you know, I walk into somebody's place, and they're like, well, here's our selection of what was the beer that was on sale at Jewel. I'd be like, oh, that's also cool. I'm not hearing the distinction. I don't know if there is one now that I've told the story. I miss beer.
So what do you think, Nicole?
I think it was a little vermouth heavy for most, but that was what sort of saved it for me, because it kept it from being too sweet. It kept it from being too much of a frou-frou cocktail, and kept it to be like a old-timey cocktail by having that balance of the salty, vermouthy flavor.
You hate Cosmos, don't you?
I don't think I've had a Cosmo.
Really?
I like cranberry juice.
Do you ever drink
juice?
Anything pink?
I like cranberry juice when it's like actual cranberry juice, not cranberry cocktail. So I guess I'm just kind of off of sweet things.
I feel like Cosmos kind of suck. You think it's going to be kind of sweet, and it is a little bit, but then there's also a lot of burn, and most people make them poorly. So they're usually not very good.
Now, the last time I had a Cosmo was 2002, and I think I liked them. I think I actually had more than one.
But yeah,
I have yet to revisit one.
but you're right. If I were to go to a martini bar or something, I wouldn't be getting the apple teeny. I'd be ordering just a gin with vermouth and a lemon rind.
And you go gin martini, not vodka.
She's like a real martini. Thank you.
Yeah. I want that botanical. I don't want it to taste like nothing like vodka does.
Well, cool. I think I'm kind of with Rachel on it. I'm not a huge martini fan, and so, like, it doesn't grab me. It doesn't make me want to, like, worship at the altar of the Ford cocktail. But it was good. It was more interesting than a regular martini. It had more going on with it, and that I can totally appreciate.
I really like that. Like what you pointed out too is like one thing that this has kind of opened up to us is the idea of basically making yourself a vermouth heavy gin martini and then adding a couple dashes of some kind of bitters and adding a couple dashes of some kind of strange liqueur, and then you have a cocktail, and you could try that endlessly with all kinds of stuff, which makes it really interesting to, like, then you really could have a little cocktail party with stuff you probably already have in your booze collection.
In my booze collection, or in most people's booze collection?
Your booze collection is just like strange things.
Exactly, because, yeah. I don't think most people have a lot of these things. I mean, my eyes have been opened up to all of the different, very secretive recipes all throughout European monasteries and families and stuff. You know, and there's a lot of them. Some of them have risen to the top, like Campari, where everybody knows them. And then some of them are just little teeny, but see, all of them tend to be a little bit more expensive because they're very boutique-y. Okay, well, I guess we've drained this dry. There's nothing else to say. I guess keep listening. Until next time, talk to you later. Bye now.
It's just begun. Oh, we're gonna get things done. Oh, we're gonna do our chores. Have a handsome family just like
Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I'd like to thank Jason Cruz for researching our content, our regular tasting team, Rachel Rubin, Kevin Rutajczyk, Bethany Lang, and Nicole Pizzini, for joining me in the grueling task of tasting the cocktails we discuss, the Brixton and their bartender, Michael Donnelly, for letting us cavort in their liquid playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blackleaderproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and as-it-happens updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver.